If you want to know who is winning a war today, you shouldn't look at a map of the trenches.
Right, because that doesn't really tell you much anymore.
Exactly. I mean, look at the price of gasoline at a civilian pump 1,000 miles away.
Yeah, the economic indicators.
Right. Because for generations, we've relied on this deeply ingrained image of a front line. You see the trenches, right? A line drawn in the sand,
yeah.
Two sides facing
off. That's a classic physical boundary.
Yes, exactly. You know exactly where the danger is and, you know, where safety begins. But if you look at the intelligence report circulating right now in June 2026, that map is, well, it's completely erased.
It really is. The physical front line is effectively obsolete at this point. When we examine the current global battle space, the whole concept of a rear echelon, you know, where troops and logistics are supposedly safe, it simply doesn't exist anymore.
Which is exactly why we are pulling out a massive stack of intelligence and reporting for you today. We're looking at sources from the Institute for the Study of War, The War Zone, Al Jazeera, and The Aviationist.
A really diverse stack of reporting.
Yeah, and our mission for this deep dive is to map out this new reality. We're connecting the dots across four major global flashpoints to show you how the very nature of military strategy has entirely shifted.
We're talking about deep logistics strikes, the weaponization of maritime choke points.
Oh, the massive automated swarms, too.
Right. We were looking at a completely boundaryless war.
Boundaryless. I like that. So let's unpack this.
Well, to understand how this boundaryless war operates, you really have to look at the intersection of military action and macroeconomics.
Right.
And that is playing out vividly right now between Ukraine and Russia. The reporting from ISW and Al Jazeera details this very deliberate shift. Ukraine is essentially bypassing the heavily fortified front lines in the east.
Right, going over them.
Exactly. Reaching deep into the Russian interior to target the infrastructural lifelines of the military.
And I want to focus on the word deep here because, I mean, the geography is staggering. Ukraine's security service, the SBU, recently hit the Bashneft refineries in Ufa.
Yeah, which is massive.
It is. Ufa is in the Bashkortostan Republic, which is over 1,500 kilometers away from the Ukrainian border.
It's a massive distance.
I'm just trying to wrap my head around the mechanics of that.
Yeah.
I mean, how does a military fly a drone 1,500 kilometers through hostile, heavily defended airspace and actually hit a specific refinery tower?
Well, it requires a huge evolution in navigation. You see, you can't rely solely on GPS anymore.
Because it gets jammed.
Exactly. Electronic warfare units will jam or spoof that signal the second the drone crosses the border. So these systems are increasingly relying on autonomous terrain mapping, right? And inertial navigation.
Wait, so they're looking at the ground?
Basically, yeah. They are programmed to recognize the physical landscape beneath them. They fly completely silent without communicating back to base at all until they reach their pre-programmed coordinate.
That's wild. And it's not just these ultra-long-range strikes either. Down in occupied Crimea, the operations are so systematic.
Oh, absolutely.
The sources note strikes completely disabling Russian S-400 missile systems in Kerch. And they are hitting electricity plants in Sevastopol.
Which is causing massive disruption.
Yeah, it's caused such a severe bottleneck that fuel for private individuals in Sevastopol has been capped at just 20 liters per week.
Wow, 20 liters. The intent there is obviously to induce localized paralysis. But, you know, the broader strategy of hitting those refineries deep in Russia, that's about creating a macroeconomic chain reaction.
Right, the ripple effect.
Exactly. According to Bloomberg data cited by ISW, these strikes caused Russian gasoline prices to spike 3% in a single week.
Wow.
Yeah, bringing it to 95 cents US per liter, and annual inflation spiked to 5.8%.
Okay, I have to pause on those numbers for a second. A 3% jump in a week sounds super painful for a regular consumer.
Yeah.
But is it really enough to cripple a national war machine? I mean, it feels like a nuisance, not a knockout blow.
Well, it's not about bankrupting the state overnight, right? It's about breaking the mechanisms the state uses to fund the war.
Like cutting off the engine's oil rather than shooting at the tires.
That's a perfect analogy. Look at the Russian Central Bank. Governor Elvira Nabiulina has been aggressively trying to manage this crisis. They previously lowered key interest rates to, I think, 14.25%. to pump cheap capital into their defense industrial base.
Because they needed factories building tanks and artillery shells.
Right. But when your domestic fuel supply is suddenly destroyed by drones and consumers start panic buying, inflation just skyrockets.
And the central bank is totally trapped. If they print more money to help people afford the gas, the inflation just gets worse. And obviously, you can't print physical barrels of oil.
Precisely. Monetary policy cannot fix a physical supply chain deficit. And, you know, the pressure isn't just internal.
Right. What happened at sea?
At the exact same time, the French Navy intercepted and seized a Russian Shadow Fleet oil tanker called the Deliver. This was right off the coast of Sicily.
Wow. So the state is losing refining capacity at home and losing its off-the-books export revenue abroad.
Exactly. A multi-front economic squeeze.
So if a nation is proving that traditional borders and air defenses can't protect a massive oil refinery deep inland, it really makes me wonder about international borders at sea.
Because they're even harder to defend.
Right. If you can't protect a stationary pipeline on land, how on earth do you protect a moving shipping lane? We are seeing this exact vulnerability exploited right now in the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah, the Strait of Hormuz is basically the ultimate geographic bottleneck.
It really is.
A huge percentage of the world's oil and liquefied natural gas flows through this channel, which, by the way, is only 21 miles wide at its narrowest point.
That is so small.
Yeah.
And the recent reporting from Al Jazeera outlines a really highly aggressive posture from Iran to assert control over this space.
Very aggressive.
Yeah, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, the IRGC Navy, actually attacked a Singapore-flagged cargo ship called the Ever Lovely.
Right, and the fallout was immediate.
A massive logistical headache. The UN's International Maritime Organization, the IMO, had to completely pause an evacuation plan they had arranged with Oman.
This was for the hundreds of ships stranded in the Gulf, right?
Exactly.
See, the attack on the Ever Lovely isn't just an isolated incident. It's an enforcement mechanism. The sources indicate Iran is attempting to enforce its own traffic separation scheme in the strait.
Basically making their own rules.
Yes. They're essentially demanding that international vessels use Iranian-approved routes and coordinate directly with their authorities. And the ultimate goal here, according to officials familiar with the plans, is to levy a service fee on Gulf states and international shipping.
Just for the right to transit.
Exactly.
A service fee. I mean, let's call it what it is. That sounds like setting up an unauthorized mafia toll booth on a busy international highway.
It really does.
I read in the sources that this could generate an estimated $40 billion annually for Tehran.
$40 billion? That's a massive revenue stream.
But practically speaking, how does the Navy enforce a toll booth in international waters? They can't put a physical gate across the ocean.
Well, they enforce it through the threat of asymmetric boarding and seizure.
Okay, what does that look like?
The IRGC Navy doesn't use massive destroyers for this. They use swarms of fast-attack speedboats, helicopters, and shore-based anti-ship missiles.
Ah, so it's a swarm tactic.
Right. If a commercial tanker refuses to acknowledge the traffic scheme or pay the fee, a swarm of speedboats just surrounds it. Armed personnel board via helicopter, and they physically steer the ship into Iranian territorial waters.
It's basically institutionalized piracy to test the international community. So I have to ask, is this purely an economic play for that $40 billion? Or is it a test to see if the international community will blink first? Like, is this about sovereignty?
It's both, actually. But the sovereignty aspect is far more dangerous.
How so?
Think about it. If international shipping companies start paying that fee just to avoid having their ships seized, they are implicitly recognizing Iranian jurisdiction over an international waterway.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they are quietly rewriting the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea.
Which totally explains the massive diplomatic pushback we saw. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio met with the Gulf Cooperation Council foreign ministers in Manama, Bahrain.
Right, to present a unified front.
Yeah, they issued a joint statement flat out rejecting any tolls and demanding unrestricted navigation.
But look at the parallel diplomacy happening at the exact same time.
What do you mean?
While the public statements in Manama are drawing a really hard line, there is a confirmed U.S.-Iran deconfliction channel operating out of Doha, Qatar.
Oh, the back channel.
Yes. U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance and Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammed Bagher Ghalibaf both confirmed this back channel exists.
That dual-track approach is so fascinating. You have the public diplomatic rejection on one stage, and then these quiet backroom negotiations on another, just trying to keep the shipping lanes open without triggering a full-on kinetic war.
Exactly. It's a very delicate balancing act.
But, you know, while Iran is trying to use a physical, geographic choke point for leverage, the intelligence out of the Korean Peninsula shows a totally different approach.
A complete pivot.
Yeah, we are looking at nations using sheer, overwhelming technology to bypass geography entirely.
The technological shift happening in Korea completely redefines the scale of asymmetric warfare. I mean, historically, the standoff across the DMZ has been defined by massed artillery, right?
Thousands of guns pointed across a physical border.
Exactly.
And North Korea is definitely still leaning into that kinetic threat. Leader Kim Jong-un is demanding what he called a deadly and destructive offensive posture.
Very strong words.
Yeah. And he's overseeing tests of a special mission, ballistic missile warhead, alongside upgraded rocket launchers and self-propelled howitzers that can reach all of South Korea.
And the sources note Pyongyang is receiving technological assistance from Russia to speed all this up.
Which is a pretty clear transactional relationship.
Very much so. Russia needs millions of rounds of traditional artillery shells for its war in Ukraine. And in exchange, North Korea gets access to advanced Russian aerospace and missile technology.
A dangerous trade.
Yeah.
But it's South Korea's response under President Lee Jae-yong that I think we really need to focus on.
It's unprecedented.
South Korea's defense ministry announced they are investing $650 million by 2030 to train 500,000 drone warriors.
Half a million.
500,000. They want to train soldiers to operate drones like they are personal firearms.
Just stop and consider what that means for the history of conflict.
Okay.
For 5,000 years, the base unit of a military was a human being holding a weapon, right?
Sure.
South Korea is looking at the demographic realities. They have a shrinking population, and they simply cannot match North Korea man for man in a traditional infantry war.
Right. The numbers just aren't there.
So they are changing the base unit of the military from a human to a precision-guided airborne swarm.
But I have to push back on the logistics of this for a second.
Mm.
Half a million drone warriors. I mean, we can barely keep civilian Wi-Fi networks stable when too many people are in a sports stadium.
That's a fair point.
So how does a military command and control a swarm of 500,000 drones in a combat zone without jamming their own signals, draining massive amounts of batteries, and just causing absolute chaos?
Well, that is the core technical hurdle. And the answer is that you cannot pilot them all manually.
Okay, so they aren't all flying them with little controllers.
No, absolutely not. You cannot have 500,000 soldiers staring at 500,000 iPads with joysticks. The bandwidth simply doesn't exist.
So what's the solution?
This investment implies a massive leap in autonomous swarming technology. The drone warrior isn't flying the drone. They are managing the algorithm.
Managing the algorithm.
Wow. Yeah. A single soldier might designate a grid square, and a swarm of, say, 50 drones autonomously communicates with itself to sweep that area, identify targets, and engage without human input for every single trigger pull.
So the human becomes a manager, not a trigger puller. That is terrifying, frankly. Are we looking at a future where warfare resembles an esports arena, but with lethal real-world consequences?
It certainly looks that way.
And it completely breaks traditional defenses. I mean, how does a traditional military even begin to defend against a swarm half a million strong? If you try to shoot down a swarm of $500 drones with a battery of $3 million Patriot missiles, you are going to bankrupt your own defense budget in an afternoon.
Exactly. The proliferation of cheap, lethal mass is an absolute nightmare for any traditional static defense system. You just cannot build a physical wall high enough to stop a digital airborne swarm.
Which perfectly brings us to our final set of sources from the War Zone and the Aviationist, because the U.S. Air Force is looking at this exact nightmare scenario.
I see the writing on the wall.
Yeah. Drone swarms, long-range strikes, contested airspace, and they're realizing their current playbook just won't survive.
They are being forced to adapt by what military strategists call A2AD.
Right. Anti-accessory denial bubbles.
Exactly. Adversaries have built these integrated air defense systems and ultra-long-range missiles designed to push American aircraft hundreds of miles away from the fight.
So the Air Force is responding with an incredible leap in reach. The sources outline a secret meeting held at Eglin Air Force Base regarding a program called the AFLRW.
The Air Force Long Range Weapon?
Yes. And the baseline requirement they've laid out is jaw-dropping. They want an air-to-air missile with a minimum range of 1,000 nautical miles.
To contextualize that distance for a second, the current workhorse air-to-air missile, the AIM-120 AMRAAM, has a range of roughly 100 miles.
So they are asking the defense industry for a tenfold increase in physical reach.
A tenfold increase, yeah.
And the targets aren't nimble fighter jets, right?
Right.
The goal is to take out critical support aircraft like AWACS radar planes and aerial refueling tankers from safely outside that A2AD bubble.
Right, because if you can't get close, you hit the support.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The sources even mentioned they might use stealth bombers, like the new B-21 Raider, as weapons trucks to carry these massive long-range missiles into position.
If you look at the architecture of modern air combat, you know, the fighter jet gets all the glory, but the AWACS and the tankers are the actual foundation.
The unsung heroes.
Definitely. And AWACS acts as a flying command center, coordinating the battle space. And the tankers keep the fighters fueled. If an adversary knocks out your AWACS, your fighters are blind.
And if they knock out your tankers, your fighters fall out of the sky.
Exactly. So a 1,000-mile missile means you don't even bother dogfighting the enemy jets. You just systematically dismantle their support network from the next time zone over.
But here's my major conceptual roadblock with this.
Okay, what is it?
I get the theory. It's like a sniper trying to hit a target on the other side of a mountain range. Building a rocket motor that can burn for 1,000 miles is, well, it's just an engineering problem, right?
Sure, fuel and thrust.
But how do you actually target a moving airplane 1,000 miles away? Because physically, the curvature of the Earth gets in the way of the launching plane's radar.
That is the most critical question. Because of the Earth's curvature, the plane launching the missile absolutely cannot see the target on its own radar.
It's just physically impossible.
The physics of radio waves make it impossible, yeah. So a weapon like this relies entirely on what the military calls a kill web.
Okay, walk me through a kill web. I've heard of a kill chain before, but how is a web different?
A kill chain is a linear closed loop, right? A single aircraft finds, tracks, and shoots a target.
One plane does it all.
Right. But a kill web is a highly networked mesh of sensors distributing that process across completely different platforms.
Okay.
So instead of a single sniper doing everything, a kill web is like having one person spot the target with binoculars, a second person calculate the wind, a third person hold the gun, and a fourth person pull the trigger.
Oh, wow.
But they are all standing on completely different continents.
That is an incredible visual. So the missile is basically just the bullet taking instructions from everywhere else in the network.
Exactly. To hit a tanker 1,000 miles away, the missile might be launched by a B-21 bomber, but the bomber doesn't even see the target.
So who does?
The initial coordinates might come from a space-based early warning satellite in low Earth orbit. Yeah. And then once the missile is flying, it might receive mid-course guidance updates beamed securely from, say, a stealth drone that is quietly loitering deep behind enemy lines.
So the missile is just the kinetic endpoint of a massive global data network.
You nailed it. It's a data network that happens to end in an explosion.
But building that network takes time. Until those 1,000-mile missiles and space-based kill webs are fully operational, the Air Force still has to deal with enemy air defenses today, right?
They do, and the Aviationist source provides a really great look at how they are adapting existing platforms right now to handle it.
Yeah, I saw this. Over at Misawa Air Base in Japan, the first F-35A stealth fighter, specifically tail number 24597Z, has just taken on the iconic WW tail code.
The WW tail code stands for Wild Weasel.
Yes, it's an incredible piece of military history. The Wild Weasel mission started back during the Vietnam War.
Really dangerous mission.
Insanely dangerous. Pilots would fly directly into heavily defended enemy airspace, basically acting as bait to force the enemy surface-to-air missile sites to turn on their targeting radars.
Just waiting to be locked onto.
Exactly. And once the enemy radar was on, the Weasels would lock onto that signal and fire a missile down the beam to destroy the site. Their motto is literally, first in, last out.
It remains the most high-risk mission in modern air combat, which is called ESSI, or the suppression of enemy air defenses.
Right.
At Misawa, the 13th and 14th fighter squadrons are currently transitioning from their older F-16s to the new F-35s, specifically to take over this mission in the Pacific.
But the sources noted a major technical catch with this.
Yeah, the missile gap.
Right. The F-35 currently does not have its dedicated internal anti-radiation missile,
yeah,
the AARGM-ER, ready for deployment yet.
It's still in development.
So if they don't have the missile designed to shoot down the radar, how are they flying a Wild Weasel mission?
They are using the aircraft itself as a directed energy weapon.
Wait, what?
Yeah. The F-35 is equipped with an incredibly powerful AESA radar. That's an active electronically scanned array.
Okay, you're going to have to break that down for me. What makes an ESI radar different from, like, a traditional spinning radar dish?
Think of a traditional radar like a flashlight. You point the beam in one direction to see what's there, right?
Sure.
And ESA radar is completely different. It's made up of thousands of tiny individual transmit and receive modules. It's like having 1,000 microscopic laser pointers that can look in entirely different directions multiple times a second without any physical dish actually moving.
Okay, I get that.
Yeah.
But how does that help them survive without a missile?
Because they can focus the energy from all those tiny modules into a highly concentrated beam of electronic attack.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So while they wait for the kinetic missiles to be ready, these F-35s are relying on their physical stealth to sneak close to the enemy defense bubble.
Right.
Then they use the ASA radar not to just look at the enemy, but to blast them with focused microwave energy and data streams.
So they're weaponizing the radar.
Exactly. They can project false targets onto the enemy's screens, jam their communications frequencies, and essentially just fry the circuitry of the enemy's integrated air defense systems using pure algorithms and electronic force.
That is unbelievable. We've gone from World War I biplanes shooting machine guns at each other to a stealth jet hovering at the edge of the atmosphere, deploying algorithms to blind an enemy radar system.
It really is a paradigm shift. And that technological evolution encapsulates everything we've discussed across these sources today.
It really ties it all together.
Physical proximity, you know, the classic idea of closing with the enemy, it's being entirely replaced by electronic reach, autonomous systems, and data networking.
When you lay it all out like that, it really shifts how you have to view the world.
It does.
I mean, if we synthesize all this reporting from Ukraine's strategy of burning down oil refineries deep inside the Russian heartland just to cripple a central bank,
right,
to Iran using speedboats to effectively charge a $40 billion toll on global maritime trade.
And then the tech side.
Yeah, you pair that with South Korea redefining the infantry with an autonomous swarm of 500,000 drones, and the U.S. Air Force building a networked kill web to shoot down planes from a completely different time zone.
The overriding takeaway here is that distance and logistics are no longer just the support elements of a war.
No.
They are the primary battleground. The objective isn't to take a physical trench anymore. The objective is to systematically dismantle an adversary's ability to supply, communicate, and operate from hundreds or even thousands of miles away.
It's an incredible and frankly sobering shift in human conflict. It leaves you with a deeply provocative thought, you know.
What's that?
If a soldier can sit in a bunker in Seoul and manage a lethal drone swarm, and a stealth jet can shoot down an enemy radar plane from 1,000 miles away using space-based targeting, does the concept of a front line even exist anymore?
Or has the entire globe simply become one giant, intimately interconnected theater of operations?
It certainly appears that the globe itself is the new front line, something to mull over as you watch the news this week. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep asking those big questions, keep looking past the surface of the headlines, and we'll catch you next time.